The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. My name is Aida Leisenring. I'm your host, along with Bruce Barquette. Hello, Bruce.
Good evening, Ms. Leisenring. How are you this evening?
I'm very well. What's going on with you? Besides, for those who are listening, obviously, since you can't see us, we had a pink microphone chaotic moment where Bruce refused to go on air with the pink coverlet for our microphone. But
old school.
So we switched. He's green. I'm pink. And we have a lot of great information coming up. I actually want to ask you something that's sort of personal.
Okay.
All right. Well, personal, not in a funny or cute way, but it's breaking news, and we are Crime and Justice News Radio. So last week we had Marty Tankliff, who was wrongfully convicted of killing his parents. And one of the most instrumental figures in his case, besides yourself, you were the attorney that was able to exonerate him and worked on his civil case.
One of them, at least.
Was an amazing investigator, Jay Salpeter, who you also know is a friend and you've worked with on other cases. Unfortunately, Jay Salpeter was arrested or voluntarily surrendered, rather, this morning, I believe. He's been indicted on attempted grand larceny in the second degree and other counts for allegedly trying to extort Marty Tankliff for some of the money that he was awarded in his civil cases. So we're not like the Cuomos. We are going to confront issues, even if they're close to home. Bruce, your thoughts about that?
Jay has been a friend and a colleague for 25 years. He has done great work for clients of mine and other clients over the course of that time. He's been involved in most of our critical or biggest cases, including Marty's. He was instrumental in Marty's case. Marty is a friend and a colleague and a former client. This is a sad day for everybody involved. The phrase, there are no winners, certainly applies here. But if the allegations are true, and he's only indicted, he's not been convicted, you can't do what Jay is alleged to have done. And it's quite sad. It's a horrible end to the relationship between these two men. It truly is. So I'm not really going to comment on it much because I kind of feel loyalty to Jay. But obviously, Marty's a friend and a colleague, and it seems that he was done wrong.
Understood. And I hope at the end they both come out of this.
Reconcile. How about
reconcile? That would be a great wish, which leads us to announcing our guest tonight, speaking of reconciliation, and she's an incredible person. Bruce, why don't you tell folks who we are going to have on today?
Look, I don't want to give it away before we get to her, but one of the best things about doing the show has been the process of preparing for it. And by that, I mean we get to speak to these individuals that we interview on the show ahead of time. And speaking with Jennifer Thompson, who is a victim of a rape, a New York Times best-selling author and the founder of a group called Healing Justice, was one of the best hours of my career over the last few years. Truly moving. Reading her website was fantastic. This is going to be a great, great show. We've had some good guests so far. I'm really looking forward to speaking with Jennifer and having our listeners hear from Jennifer.
And just so you know, Bruce, I take full credit because when I was an intern at the Innocence Project, Jennifer Thompson came in and spoke about what anyone would think is the most horrific experience in their life. And what her book is based on, Picking Cotton, is she was brutally raped. She identified her attacker. He was successfully prosecuted. And then nearly two decades later, she discovers that it was a mistaken ID, and he was exonerated by DNA. And worse was that the real perpetrator had been out for years.
Raping other people.
Right. So
the crazy part about this, and I say crazy, it's The most interesting part of her story is not that. The most interesting part of her story is what she's done since then with healing justice, restorative justice, working with the victims of wrongful convictions, both the individuals charged and the victims of crime. It's going to be fascinating. But let's get on to a few other things before we speak to her. Derek Chauvin's been indicted again, as has the three individuals who were with him, the other three officers. I actually, you know, we could talk about this all hour, but to some degree, it's boring to me. He's been indicted again. The man's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. The feds indicted him for violating George Floyd's civil rights, depriving him his right to be free from excessive force, and charged the other officers with willfully refusing to aid Floyd.
It's boring if you're a defense attorney and you've heard the story and the allegations before, but what's new and interesting about it is if he actually gets convicted of this, he faces life in prison. I still can't believe my eyes when I read it, the possible sentence. It says he may be sentenced to death, and that just sounds absurd to me, but he is facing a lot more jail time, and the federal playground is not fun. It's no joke.
Not if you're a defendant or a defense attorney, for the most part. And look, to all our friends who support the death penalty, do you want to see Derek Chauvin executed?
The interesting thing about what's happening with Derek Chauvin right now is that it seems like for the first time, the media is looking at people in power, prosecutors, police officers, mainly police officers, and realizing that they should be held accountable for their misdeeds. And recently, we had news of George Bell, if you'll tell folks about that, which involved not police, well, involved police misconduct. It involved just about every possible leading cause of wrongful conviction, but in particular, prosecutorial misconduct.
The George Bell case is a fascinating case. It comes out of Queens. It will receive national attention. It has already to some degree. George Bell was an individual who was 19 years old when he was charged with killing two men in a botched check cashing robbery in 1996. The Queens DA's office indicted him, Rohan Bolt, and Gary Johnson, and charged them with murder. In George Bell's case, they charged him with capital murder. In George Bell's case, they sought to execute him in New York. They sought the death penalty. They wanted him to be put to death by lethal injection. And as it turns out, all these many years later, after 24 years in prison, the jury spared his life. He was given life without parole. The other two men were given 50 to life. But the DA's office apparently had evidence that a gang called the Speed Stick Gang had committed the robberies and murders and withheld that evidence for all of this time. This is a difficult conversation for you and I to have. I know the defense attorneys who tried that case. I talked to them about the case as the trial was going on, and I know both of the prosecutors in this case, one better than the other. It was stunning for me to read about what happened here and to learn the depth of the alleged misconduct by the prosecutors, the police, really all the law enforcement involved in this.
And let's not forget, it also involved three false confessions. So two of the three defendants falsely confessed, and there were big hints that they were false confessions because the facts that they gave weren't consistent with actual known facts. But in particular, one of the individuals who falsely confessed, and I think did 2 years awaiting his release before he was exonerated, falsely confessed to the crime, and there was video evidence, like video, actual video surveillance of him in Washington, D.C., or an entirely different state during the time of the offense. He was clearly absolutely innocent.
Well, let's be clear what happened here. They put three men on trial. George Bell supposedly confessed. Another individual, Rohan Bolt, supposedly confessed. And a third individual by the name of Jason Ligon, who wasn't tried, also confessed. That's the person you're referring to. What the DA's office did is they kept Jason Ligon in prison or in jail for 3 years, waiting for Bolt, Johnson, and Bell to be convicted before they released him and dismissed the case because they didn't want the Bell defense attorneys to find out that these cops had extracted a provably false confession from another individual.
So they kept him in jail knowing, having possession of the actual video surveillance that sealed his alibi. Right. And that brings me to a report. The National Registry of Exonerations put out a report, actually September of 2020. Not much news was had about it, but I thought it was remarkable. Out of 2,400 exonerations that they studied since 1989, the registry found misconduct in 54% of all exonerations, rising to 72% in cases in which exonerees had been sentenced to death. Police misconduct occurred in 35% of the cases, while prosecutors committed misconduct in 30% of the exonerations. And critically, prosecutors, as here in Bell, were responsible for most of the concealing of exculpatory evidence and misconduct at trial.
This was particularly egregious in this case. And look, they might be retried. So far, the convictions have been vacated. And we're talking about this case this week. We're going to talk about it again because sometime around June 5th or before, the DA's office in Queens is going to decide whether or not to retry these men. I can't imagine that they'll do that, but the decision hasn't been made yet.
And the prosecutors, you know, have the among the best reputations in the community. They're not known to be evil, nefarious, tricksters.
We know them both. One we know pretty well. I was stunned by these allegations, and it's a horrible thing. It's a horrible thing that happened here. And if think about that, 24 years in prison for a crime they potentially did not commit, with tons of exculpatory material in the hands of the DA's office that they did not disclose.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Crime and Justice Radio is brought to you by the law firm of Parkett, Epstein, Kieran, Aldea, and Loturco, defending individuals accused of state and federal crimes, prosecuting the government for violations of your civil rights, fighting to overturn wrongful convictions, and seeking to make you whole if you've been injured in an accident. You can find them at www.barkettepstein.com or call 516-745-1500. Barkett Epstein meets all your litigation needs, from the Hudson to the Hamptons.
Back to Crime and Justice Radio. My name is Aida Leisenring. I'm your host, along with Bruce Barkett. And we're about to have Jennifer Thompson, founder of Healing Justice Project, on shortly. And actually, as a lead-in, we were talking about George Bell's wrongful conviction, along with his two other co-defendants. And the judge wrote this incredible decision outlining every detail of what went wrong. And a lot of judges hold back and say, you know, the prosecutors, you know, didn't do this in bad faith. But here, the judge challenged that and said, I believe they were clearly aware of this evidence. Not only that, the defense lawyers repeatedly asked for it, and it was denied.
They mocked the defense attorneys when they requested this information, saying they were on a fishing expedition. And the trial judge, Arthur Cooperman, who deserves to be named for this, back in 1999, called the request a fishing expedition in the Sahara Desert.
And we've been there when prosecutors or judges roll their eyes at us when we're asking for something that they claim to be a fishing expedition. But the judge made this ultimate point, which I think is extremely profound and just perfect for our next guest.
The judge reversing the case.
Yeah, the judge reversing the case. Thank you for the distinction. Yeah. So he writes, and I'll quote him, belatedly discovered Brady violations, which is exculpatory evidence, committed in murder cases, especially in capital murder cases, merit the strongest possible condemnation because they deprive the defendant of a fair trial and also deprive the victim's family of a determination as to whether the defendant was responsible for the homicide, and if so, the imposition of a just sentence. He goes on, these three defendants were undoubtedly wronged by the district attorney's office misconduct. But that misconduct, which may have been motivated by an understandable, though obviously misguided desire to seek justice for the victims and the victims' loved ones will now, nearly a quarter century after these tragic murders, likely cause the people most affected to revisit them and to be deprived of whatever semblance of closure they may have experienced after these three men were convicted.
Unbelievable. And that brings us right to Jennifer Thompson, who is one of these victims that was harmed by a wrongful conviction herself. She's the founder of Healing Justice and lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She's a rape survivor from a case involving a wrongful conviction and an exoneration. She's also a co-author with the man who was wrongly convicted of her rape of a New York Times bestseller, Picking Cotton. Jennifer presents frequently to various audiences across the country, including colleges, law schools, criminal justice conferences, state legislatures about sexual violence, justice reform, and eyewitness misidentification. We're so lucky to have her. Jennifer, welcome.
Good evening, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, get to it. Tell us what Healing Justice is all about.
Healing Justice is 6 years old, just this past April. I founded it and launched it in the spring of 2015 as a way to begin the conversation of what happens after the exoneration takes place for everyone involved. I had been working in the criminal justice system arena for several decades, you know, since the rape had happened and Ronald was exonerated and we became friends. I was kind of thrust into this space that I was ill-equipped to inhabit, to be honest with you, because I didn't know what was happening to me. But through the years of working in it, I was able to kind of collect stories and grief and losses from everyone involved in these wrongful conviction cases, from exonerated men and women and their families, but also crime survivors from these cases. And what was so hard for me to understand and so sad was that once the exoneration has taken place, once the men and women go home to their families and try to create some, quote, normalcy from their lives, the crime survivors are struggling to figure out what happened, you know, what happens next. Does anybody care about who raped me? Does anybody care about who killed my child or my sibling or my husband or my wife or my parent? There was no space for that, right? It's just person's free, and now we're done. And I was getting these phone calls, and I was sitting in space with people who were literally on the verge of suicide. And so I decided in the spring of 15, after Ronald and I both received the Special Courage Award from the Department of Justice during Victims' Rights Week.
From the Attorney General himself, as I believe, right?
Right. Eric Holder himself, which was amazing. When he gave me the award, he came over and whispered in my ear, and he said, "Thank you for what you do," because he was aware of the work I'd been doing for so long. But, you know, again, there was not a space to talk about the aftermath or the aftercare from wrongful convictions. And so I launched it in that spring. I hired a brilliant woman, Katie Monroe, whose mother was wrongfully convicted of murder many years ago, and Katie fought for 11 years to bring her mother home. She became the executive director, and the two of us kind of started this whole project. What has been really sad to witness, and Katie's the first person to talk about this, is the lack of voices from these crime survivors, that once these cases unfold and the wrongful conviction, you know, is now public and the exoneration has taken place and the cameras, you know, we're filming the words from the newly freed person, and they ask the questions, where are you going to eat and what do you want to do next? What is missing from that narrative, and, you know, you kind of touched on this, is the voice from the crime survivors. What happened to us? And we are erased out of the narrative. We go completely unnoticed out of the story. And because of that, people, the public, are not really getting a full picture of the catastrophic harm that is created when the criminal justice system fails.
And you mentioned something. So I was naive, I think, until I heard your story in law school. And when you think about the crazy numbers of, you know, contributors to wrongful convictions, among them being mistaken identification. I think that's 80% of exonerations were a result of mistaken identifications. That means that you have all those individuals that were actually crime victims, rape victims, or possibly loved ones of people that were murdered, that all of a sudden, you know, 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later, their world is turned upside down. But you mentioned in some of these cases, they're not even notified that the person, is that true?
That is absolutely true.
That's stunning. That's absolutely stunning.
And it should break your heart, because here you have someone who's lost a loved one to not cancer, not a car wreck, but violence. And that understanding that the last moments of your child or parent was just horrific violence against their bodies, the fear. And then from the rape survivors who one day are leading perfectly normal lives and the next day our worlds are shattered and smashed into millions of pieces.
Unbelievable. Jennifer, we're going to take a relatively short break. We'll be back soon. We want to talk to you some more about healing justice and about this phrase that you used, restorative justice. I'm interested in how that works in your group. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. I'm Bruce Barquette, along with my esteemed co-host, Aida Leisenring, and we're lucky to have Jennifer Thompson on the line to talk about her group, Healing Justice. Jennifer, I want to talk to you a little bit about what inspired you to begin this, and in that context, can you tell our listeners about Janet Burke and Thomas Hainsworth?
Sure. I mean, what inspired me was my own journey through sexual assault, sexual violence, you know, attempted murder as a young girl, trusting the system to get it right, having been brought through, you know, what's really considered a very flawed criminal justice procedure, which is photographic and physical lineups. You do everything that you think is the right thing to do. You go to trial, you feel like you've helped create public safety, that you're protecting other women, and then 11 years later to find out through a DNA test that not only was an innocent man incarcerated for that crime, but a guilty person had been left out to commit many, many more other incredibly violent crimes against other women in the community. And so, you know, there's that one level of harm, which is the violence against your body, the devastation to your life, the complete, you know, undoing of everything you had planned on, and then you try to move forward to find out that your world is now being upended and you're brought to your knees again, but very differently, because now the general public and people that are out in the community, for whatever reason, wants to blame you for what happened to Ronald as opposed to blaming the actual perpetrator and the system for what happened to Ronald.
Can I ask, because I noticed, and for our listeners, if you go on www.healingjusticeproject.org, you can literally click on, I think it's the About section, and see beautiful pictures of some of the participants in your project. They're insanely compelling stories that each one of them are made for a crime novel mystery, bestseller on its own. But what I realize is a lot of these individuals, some of them, were raped, were wronged, were attacked, and they picked out the wrong individual. And just like you say, you were blamed for it. But that's just ridiculous. It's not the individual's fault who is certain but is mistaken. It's not nefarious. It's not intentional. So after hearing from all of them, are there common elements into their experience that contributed to the wrongful conviction, whether through how they were treated by law enforcement or what happened?
Well, I mean, I would think there are, yes, there's common themes. I mean, the first common theme I would say is you're under incredible trauma. I mean, you've been traumatized. You've been beaten. You've been threatened. You've been almost murdered. You've been chased through the you know, the woods. You're traumatized. And then you're asking a traumatized brain to look at photographs or people and render a judgment based on really incomplete information, right? So there's someone who gathers in your description, comes up with a suspect, unbeknownst to the person, comes up with a photographic or physical lineup, gives you a limited array of people to look at. You have been traumatized. You assume that there's a suspect in there that is the person who did this to you. Otherwise, they wouldn't be showing this to you. And so there's a lot, that's what's happening in your brain. Many of us were given confirmation bias. We were told that good job, in my case, I was told good job, that's who we thought it was. In other cases, it's, you know, clapping hands or tapping a finger on a photograph. So one of the things that people need to really, really understand, I mean, and it's very simple, but for whatever reason, it escapes normal readers and viewers of cop shows and, you know, articles that are in the newspaper, is that no crime victim in the world wants an innocent person to go to prison. Nobody. I mean, we all want the person who hurt us or our families to be held, you know, accountable. We want to receive justice. And in many cases, I do believe it's not a bad actor, so to speak. It's someone who's got limited resources, maybe limited training, maybe has their eye out for somebody who's done something similar to that in the past or whatever.
You're talking about the police in this context. And sometimes they're bad actors, and sometimes they play God, and sometimes they think they know who did it, so they want to put their finger on the scale, and that's how these mistakes happen.
Right. We do know there's bad actors. You know, we also know there's police that are trying to do their best, and they just get it wrong. But there's this kind of chain of events that takes place, and you know, if this was a factory, somebody could stop the line and say, oh my God, that's the wrong screw you put into the car. But we don't have that in law. There's no one looking at the chain of events and saying, hang on a second. I think maybe going down the wrong way. And so it's just this chain of events that takes place until you eventually end up in a court where jurors are asked to make decisions based on inaccurate or incomplete facts, or sometimes, you know, complete lies.
One of the things that I found to be, again, revealing, and I've been practicing law for 35 years, and I can't believe that this has escaped my kind of purview over the course of that time, is I listened today to the video that's on your website from Toshima Artis, if I said her name correctly, who was a victim at 12 years old, and she said what stunned her, or what stunned me, was that at the end of the day, she was the only one who apologized. She felt like she was the only person to have to endure any blame. The police who participated in this, the jurors, the judge, the prosecutors, the defense attorney, none of them were in the court. None of them were being asked, what do you think about the mistake you made? It was just her.
That's right. That's right. And that is not an unusual event. I can tell you that almost every crime survivor that we work with has never been apologized to, has spent decades apologizing for something that was never theirs to apologize for, but has carried the weight of blame because the media has put it on us, the public has put it on us, sometimes families have put it on us, and we have carried this blame that was never ours to carry. But I will tell you this, in the thousands of times I've told my story on a stage and flayed my skin open and presented myself naked and raw, no one has ever said to me in a public auditorium or in a public speech, no one has looked at me and said, oh my God, I am so sorry for what Bobby Poole did to you.
That's
no one.
And Bobby Poole's the person who actually raped you.
Bobby Poole's who raped me, raped another woman 1 hour later, and went on to commit more and more violent crimes, 24 throughout the next 9 months he was free.
Unbelievable. This brings me to brings us to the next point, which is, how in God's name do you come to the point where you can talk about restorative justice? Which, and I'm going to read the quote from your website. It says it's a century-old concept of bringing together the victims, the people who harm them, and their respective communities to deal with the crime and agree upon a series of remedial measures designed to bring about reparations rather than meeting out punishment. How did you get to that point?
You know, it's organic, to be honest with you. Most of my journey has been incredibly organic. Just things have happened. You know, you kind of stand there at this crossroad and decide, do I take a right or a left? In my case, when Ronald was exonerated in 95, the next 2 years, I tried to make myself as small as I could possibly be because the world was looking for me and the world wanted to blame me, and it was scary. But 2 years after he came home, I was really stuck and debilitated. I was literally paralyzed. So I reached out to him through a neutral source and asked for a meeting, and we met not far from where I'd been raped in 1997, and we sat in this room alone and began to tell each other what had happened to ourselves, the experiences that we had gone through, the grief, the losses, the questions, things that we needed to say to each other. And that kind of in its core, it's, you know, innocence is really what restorative justice is. Now, we didn't know that. It wasn't until 2 years later someone asked me to present about restorative justice, and I kind of, you know, scratched my head and said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And the person said, well, but you've done this. Like, this is what you did. And I didn't understand that that's what I had done, but it was indeed what I did. So in 2014, again, in this space of trying to figure out, you know, what do all of us that have been harmed from these nightmares, how do we move into the next space, right? How do we begin to heal and recover and reconcile? And we did, myself and a gentleman who was at that time the executive director of Northern California Innocence Project, worked with a restorative justice practitioner to host the very first wrongful conviction retreat. And I knew it would work, but we did it in very small numbers, and we brought together three crime survivors and four exonerated individuals for the weekend to begin to explore these ideas of these common ways that we were all hurt.
And it's not just victims of crime. It's the people that have been exonerated, their families, the victims themselves and their families, to deal with the trauma that the system has inflicted on all of you.
Right. There's something really special. And the only word I could really been able to come up with is magical. When you build a safe container where people who have had these unbelievable traumas and griefs, and not a grief, right? We're talking about complicated polyvictimization, right? We're talking about long enduring grief, years and years, decades and decades. When you bring them together in a safe space where they can begin to unfold, where they can begin to lean into each other, where they begin this idea of social witnessing of each other's stories, and this idea of understanding that, like, there is a space where we belong, and these outcast parts of ourselves are welcome here. And we talk about the parts of us that were lost and what we need to do going forward, and we explore those ways.
Yeah, it is. A wonderful organization from what I've seen. We have healingjusticeproject.org. We urge people to go to the website and take a look at it and contribute to it and support it if you can. It's an unbelievable. Spend 20 minutes on the website and your life will be changed. No joke.
Or spend two and you'll want to spend 20 minutes.
Right. And Jennifer, exactly. Jennifer, just hang on for about 30 seconds. We'll be right back. We want to finish our conversation with you.
Crime and Justice Radio is brought to you by the law firm of Parkett, Epstein, Kieran, Aldea, and Loturco, defending individuals accused of state and federal crimes, prosecuting the government for violations of your civil rights, fighting to overturn wrongful convictions, and seeking to make you whole if you've been injured in an accident. You can find them at www.barkettepstein.com or call 516-745-1500. Barkett Epstein meets all your litigation needs from the Hudson to the Hamptons.
Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. I'm your host, Aida Leisenring, with Bruce Barquette, and we have guest Jennifer Thompson, founder of HealingJusticeProject.org, with us. Jennifer, before we broke shortly, we were talking about restorative justice and about having what I characterize as really innocent victims, right? Crime victims that ultimately resulted in a wrongful conviction and the wrongfully convicted and their family members. I'm curious, do you ever facilitate, or what are your views about facilitating what they do often in death penalty work, is victim outreach by the people who are not innocent victims or innocent actors, but are real perpetrators or people that have been convicted? So the victim meets her true attacker.
Mm-hmm. So I have not facilitated those, and I'm not opposed to facilitating those. You know, currently, really, my work is kind of all-consuming with the work that we do. We're the only organization in the world that works with everyone harmed in a wrongful conviction case. So there's a lot of work out there for us. As a matter of fact, there's more work that we can handle because we're a fairly small organization in scope. But I did just recently help in a juvenile case where I was helping to work through restorative justice practices with a young woman and a young man, and it's been really remarkable to watch both of them get what they need and hold actors accountable, but not want to destroy each other's lives. And in death penalty cases, you know, it's very complicated, as you can, you know, imagine.
Yep.
We do more than imagine, unfortunately.
The problem with our system is that we don't actually ask crime survivors what they need to move forward and to heal. We simply allow for punishment, you know, revenge and vengeance, and there's not a whole lot of space to engage crime survivors in what they truly, truly need. And what all crime survivors will tell you at the very core of what we need is we need to know that whoever harmed us will not do this again. And there's many ways that we can ensure that don't necessarily require executing people.
Right.
Right.
In some cases, extremely long sentences. We hear from prosecutors as defense lawyers again and again, you know, the victim wants 20 years, does not approve of downward departure to 17. But when we play with the word closure, and I don't know what that means, and Bruce always says, I hate that word, I don't understand it. Do people get closure after a conviction and sentence? I imagine it takes more than just that to get it.
You know, Bruce, I'm with you. I can't stand the word closure.
Excellent. I felt bad for a moment.
No,
thank you.
No, I agree. I agree.
No, I don't understand what it means either. It's like grief, right? Like there's, like when you lose someone, you never stop grieving them. So there's no closure to that. What there is possible is the capacity to move through things and make meaning out of messes that occur in our lives. So there is the capacity to take horrific things that have happened to us and find purpose that give us agency and our voices and our power back. But closure, you know, when you're a victim of a violent crime, that wound that you have is there, and it's always there, and it always hurts, and it's raw. And when you touch it, you go, ouch. Like, it doesn't go away, but what we do know is if we give people the opportunity to lift their voices up and find ways that they can engage in something that makes sense to them and makes sense to their families, that's where the restoration happens. That's where the reconciliation happens. And at the end of the day, that's what we need to be offering our crime survivors. That's what we need to be offering our victims.
That is unbelievable. I don't want to sound like I'm being patronizing, but I want to say how sorry I am for what you went through and how thankful I am for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Bruce. I really appreciate that. It's been
And the work you're doing to prevent more wrongful convictions in the future, which also contributes to less, a word I learned from you, wrongful liberties.
Leaving the guilty party out to commit more crime.
Exactly. And you've contributed significantly to that.
Jennifer, it's been great to have you. I wish we had a three-hour show so we can continue this. We'll be in touch. We'll be in touch. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. And we'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
I know.
Right?
She was... I mean, when you're in law school, I can't tell you how many speakers you have to listen to. And I don't remember 99.9% of them, but I remembered her.
And
I was so floored by, you know, her energy, her eloquence, her ability to get me to understand a concept I didn't get,
I'll tell you that when we started this show, we said we're going to take a different look at the criminal justice system. And we've had a prosecutor, a police officer, an executioner, a person that was wrongly convicted, and now a victim of both crime and the wrongful conviction of one of the individuals involved.
And a huge advocate for wrongful convictions. We have
healingjusticeproject.org. Go to the site, and what Aida said is correct. Spend 2 minutes, and you'll want to spend 20, and support the group. Give them some money. They deserve it. They need it. It'll go to a good cause. I'll tell you this. Our firm will. I will. We'll certainly support it. Who do we have up next week?
So we have a very fascinating woman. Her name is Sarah Edmondson. She's a Canadian actress. But she was involved as a whistleblower to the sex trafficking cult NXIVM.
The sex trafficking cult?
Yes. Kenneth Rainier was the founding member and the leader, and he ended up getting convicted in federal court. I believe he was sentenced to 120 years. There were educated people that were participants in this cult, not knowing it was a cult, thinking it was a self-help group. And I know her through my friend from college.
All right.
So
we'll see you in a week. We'll both be back next week, same time, same place.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.